Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The U.S. military is searching southern Afghanistan near the Pakistan border for 23-year-old Private Bo Bergdahl of Idaho. The Pentagon confirmed that Bergdahl is the American soldier who was captured outside his base in Afghanistan almost 3 weeks ago. Private Bergdahl, who had been in Afghanistan for just a few months, was identified after he appeared in a video posted online over the weekend.
Well, I am scared. I'm scared I won't be able to go home. I have my girlfriend who is hoping to marry. I have a very, very good family. I'm afraid that I might never see them again and that I'll never be able to tell them that I love them again.
Sue Martin is owner of Zaney's River Street Coffee House in Haley, Idaho, where Private Bergdahl worked for 2 years. And Sue, can you tell us how people there are reacting to the news that Bo was captured?
It's been a struggle for everybody. I think it's understandable. Everybody's been on hold, just waiting to see what they could do, how they could show their support. I spoke with Bo's father yesterday, and he asked if we could handle the interviews and all the press here at the coffee shop, and that people could perhaps do their, their shows of support here at the coffee shop.
So you sort of have a way set up at the coffee shop to do almost like a vigil for Bo.
Yes, people will be bringing ribbons and flowers and notes and whatever they feel is appropriate. We live in a very supportive community.
Do you know why he joined the military?
I don't know exactly why. I mean, I know that Bo is always interested in learning and always furthering himself, and I think that he considered himself a good match.
Did you watch the video that was on the internet, Sue?
I watched a very minimum part of the video. It was difficult.
Yeah. Well, our thoughts are with you, and we hope that this story will have a happy ending.
Thank you very much.
Sue Martin is owner of Zaney's River Street Coffee House in Haley, Idaho. Sue, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We now go to Gordon Lubold. He covers the Pentagon for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gordon, what does this video say or tell us maybe about how negotiations might go for the release of the soldier?
This video, which is particularly long, you know, will be studied and is being studied and analyzed by intel officers and other specialists who are probably reading into it more than what any of us with the kind of bare eye could see, looking for signals that he may, in this case a soldier, may be trained to convey kind of privately through the video in his answers and in his eye movements and in the way he's acting.
And in the video itself, it was difficult to see his eyes when he was speaking, but they would there were sort of close-up shots of him when he was eating.
Right. I thought that was strange, actually. And who knows what the motivation of the people shooting the video is in showing him eating like that. I don't think the downcastness necessarily means anything, because it could be that he's trying to send a signal.
Now, the Monitor actually reports that there are experts who say that this kidnapping may be the work of the Haqqani network, and a leader of that network is considered a terrorist mastermind. What does that mean?
Well, the Haqqani network is more closely associated with al-Qaeda than it is with the Taliban, or at least considered to be, and it's kind of emerged as one of the more prominent, if you will, networks that is causing a lot of the problems in and along the border. We still don't really understand the circumstances in which DFC Bergdahl was taken, whether he was just kind of straying outside of the base, which seems very unlikely, or taken some other way.
It's also difficult to understand exactly who might be responsible. I thought last week we heard that a Taliban commander said his men were holding Private Bergdahl.
Right, and we'll continue to get this conflicting reporting. But often, he may be kidnapped by one, but then he's traded up, if you will, to a higher-level commander. And there are deals made between these commanders all the time. They know they have kind of a hot one now. And it's good and bad, because I think it's really hard to keep secret that you have somebody. So as the military goes, and they're not at least publicly going to be doing any kind of negotiating to get him back, but they are searching for him and using their intelligence and going into the field. But it strikes me that it is hard to keep secret that you have an American soldier, especially now that he's been named and he's got a face, he's got the video, obviously, he starts to have a much higher profile.
Gordon Leubold covers the Pentagon for the Christian Science Monitor. He's been talking with us about the capture of Private Bo Bergdahl of Idaho. Thanks very much for being with us, Gordon.
Thanks for having me.
If you were alive 40 years ago today, you and your family or friends were likely huddled around a rabbit-eared black and white television staring at the grainy images of astronaut Neil Armstrong about to fulfill an American dream, walking on the moon.
I'm at the foot of the ladder, although the surface appears to be very, very fine-grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder.
Armstrong's next step, the small one that he said was a giant leap for mankind, left the U.S. the winner of a decade-long space race with the Soviet Union. It also left people wondering, what's next? Mars, our neighbor, seemed the logical destination, but four decades later, there is still no coherent strategy to get there. Gene Kumagai is senior editor at IEEE Spectrum, the magazine for technology insiders, which has published a special edition called To the Red Planet, Humanity's Greatest Adventure is Within Our Grasp. And Gene, why should there be a human mission to Mars?
I guess there are very compelling scientific reasons for going to Mars, and there's also what I'll call aspirational reasons. So the science first. Apart from Earth, Mars is the most Earth-like, human-friendly place, and it's our closest planetary neighbor. Geologists who study Mars believe its early history may have been very similar to Earth's. So the question is, did life evolve there, too, at some point? Just last year, NASA confirmed that there's water on Mars in the form of ice. So could life still exist there? If we could find life on Mars, that would be a huge discovery. It would utterly change our thinking about life and, you know, our own place in the cosmos, which leads me to the other, probably even more compelling reason. Sending people to Mars would really transform the human experience. We are explorers. It's one of the things we like to do. Maybe it's something that we have to do, and undertaking a mission to Mars would really push us, not just technologically, but also as a society, in a way that very few endeavors ever could.
Certainly there's been a lot of speculation about what Mars might be like, whether it was, you know, The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells or A Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs. We've had a fascination with what Mars actually is, if humans actually might be able to travel there someday. When do you think, though, it was something that was considered a possibility and something that scientists seriously thought they could pursue?
Serious thinking really began with the dawn of the modern rocket era. The father of modern rocketry was a Nazi engineer named Wernher von Braun. After the war, he came to the U.S., and he oversaw the development of the rockets that eventually put Neil Armstrong on the moon. From pretty much the moment he came to the U.S. until his death in 1977, he continually lobbied for a manned Mars mission. He also tried really hard to fire up the public's imagination about Mars. He published magazine articles about it. He did TV specials for Disney. He even wrote a rather awkward sci-fi novel about Mars. And well into the Nixon administration, von Braun was still calling for a Mars landing by the 1980s.
It doesn't look like in any way that there's any kind of plan to get to Mars in any time in the near future. So what are some of the obstacles?
Mars is hard. I mean, there's no question about it. Just to take the biggest engineering challenge, that would be the propulsion, the rockets. The Apollo program relied on chemical rockets. And at the moment, chemical rockets are what most people think we'll use to send people to Mars. But they're really expensive and they weigh a lot. So rocket scientists have come up with all kinds of competing ideas that would get you to Mars quicker. They include things like electric rockets that could be powered by nuclear reactors or maybe solar power, to things like a magnetic sail that would use plasma particles. Some people have seriously considered an antimatter rocket.
So basically, actually getting there is a big problem. Is it time-consuming?
Using a chemical rocket, you're looking at 6 months minimum, and then you're spending either weeks or maybe 18 months on the Martian surface, and then you got to get back home. So total, 2.5 years. And once you're out there, I mean, space is a very harsh place. Here on Earth, we're protected from most of that by the atmosphere and the magnetic field and gravity. But out in space, you get these extreme solar storms that kick out lots of radiation, which, depending on how severe they are, it'll either kill you quickly or slowly. So if you're on, let's say, a three-year mission to Mars, you would be exposed to the equivalent of about 26,000 dental x-rays, which is a lot. And so any vehicle heading to Mars would need a lot of radiation protection. And then there are other cosmic rays that can cause brain damage. In the long term, they could cause cancer. There's very little atmosphere, so you can't breathe the air. It's mostly carbon dioxide. So you need to carry, you know, your air supply at all times. And you need some sort of suit to protect you from, you know, the very low atmospheric pressure. Otherwise, you know, your blood cells will come out of solution, and it would be a very unpleasant way to go. It's a dry place. I mean, there is water in the form of ice, but you need to bring some water also. You need to bring fuel. You need to bring food. You know, it's not going to be like a trip to Paris. It's going to be more like a really, really extreme camping trip, and you'll need to bring a lot of stuff with you, and possibly you could figure out a way to sort of live off the land there, you know, produce your own fuel, you know, melt and purify the ice for drinking water.
Say that some of these obstacles, the landing, the getting there, the radiation, say that there is a way that scientists figure out how to deal with some of those, and there is a mission sent to Mars. What would it be like for the crew?
The crew would experience really the extremes of boredom and excitement and stress and, you know, kind of, I mean, a lot of people think that the psychological stress will actually be one of the hardest things about the mission.
If they did go, what would they do once they got to Mars?
Obviously, the search for signs of life, either present or past, would be a very high priority. They would spend some time just surveying the surface. You know, a lot of what we know about Mars comes back from satellite imagery and from, you know, the Mars rovers Spirit and Opportunity. But the rovers, for example, have only covered a few kilometers of ground, and the satellites, you know, they're looking from on high. You get a much different sense of what things look like on the ground than you could get from looking from, you know, a few 100 kilometers above the surface.
The title of your magazine's special edition is To the Red Planet, Humanity's Greatest Adventure is Within Our Grasp. How soon do you think that it would be realistically possible for a manned mission to get to Mars? And do you think that we'll see that anytime soon, really?
If there is political will, if we are willing to spend the, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars, if there is some very good technological leadership in terms of structuring the program and kind of getting the right people to work on these problems, yeah, we could do it in, you know, say 20 years' time. It's really a matter of kind of deciding to do it. The program has really been kind of drifting in the last few years, and what would really be required is somebody with a very clear vision to come in and say, this is the plan, and this is what we're going to do.
So is there the political will to go to Mars? We'll have more after a quick break. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about the possibility of a manned mission to Mars. Our guest is Jean Kumagai, senior editor at IEEE Spectrum magazine. And Jean, before the break, we were talking about some of the engineering obstacles that have to be overcome before we can even think about sending people to Mars, like building the necessary rockets to get there, selecting the right kind of crew for what could be a long and intensely stressful mission, not to mention the cost, estimated somewhere around $500 billion. President Obama has a lot of down-to-earth problems on his plate these days, like healthcare reform and two wars. So where does he stand on the idea of a mission to Mars?
To take the cost first, yes, definitely not the cheapest thing you could do. If we were to undertake a human mission to Mars, it would be obviously spread out over a couple of decades. But everybody thinks that it will have to be an international effort because really no one country can pay for everything. As for where President Obama stands, that is still an open question. I mean, he's clearly not a space buff. he came into office, he had very clear, well-articulated thoughts on just about everything except for human spaceflight. On the other hand, he named as the next NASA administrator a former astronaut who is very big on human spaceflight.
And who is the former astronaut who will be the next NASA administrator?
He's a guy named Charles Bolden. He is an engineer by training. He has years of experience in the astronaut corps. Nobody seems to have a bad word to say about him, and that would be a nice change for NASA. Their previous administrator, Michael Griffin, was a very divisive guy. I mean, very hard-charging, but not everybody kind of could rally around him.
And also the president has a committee looking into human spaceflight, isn't that right?
That's right. For very good reasons, he wanted to take a look at what we're spending our money on in the NASA human spaceflight program, and so he appointed this Blue Ribbon panel. It's led by the chairman of Lockheed Martin, a guy named Norman Augustine. And what's interesting also about that commission, though, is that it's kind of loaded with human spaceflight proponents. He's got a bunch of former astronauts there. Sally Ride is on the committee. He's got you know, people involved, heavily involved in space tourism. And I'm actually looking forward to their findings, which should be out next month. So by the fall, we should have a pretty good idea of where we stand on going to Mars.
You mentioned that it would have to be probably an international effort to do something like this. Do you think that competitive spirit of space travel that was around during the first, moon launch is still around today? Has it changed?
It's definitely changed in places like the U.S. and Europe. But when you look at some of the other space players now, like China and India, they are really keen on sending people into space. Both China and India have pretty concrete plans for sending humans to the moon. Whether or not they can pull that off in the next decade is still an open question. But they definitely see value in human spaceflight. So it would be nice to think that a manned mission to Mars could be done kind of more cooperatively and less kind of competitively. I don't know if we're yet at that stage where we can do that. If you look at the International Space Station, that was supposed to be a very international cooperative thing. The Europeans ended up being quite angry at the U.S. about how the space station developed.
What about the general public? You know, you mentioned at the beginning certainly that it's almost part of human nature to want to explore. But do people still have that sense of urgency about exploration in space?
Well, it's definitely mixed. People will point out that we have very, very big problems right now. We have economic problems. We have environmental problems. We have wars going on, and that's true, but it's always true. There was never a time when we weren't kind of struggling to get along here on the planet, and that goes back to Lewis and Clark or Columbus coming to the New World. Or it's kind of never a good time to explore new places, but maybe it's always a good time to take on these tough challenges. And when you look at school kids, they're still incredibly interested in space. Astronauts go out to visit classrooms. I mean, the kids are just, like out of their seats. They are so beside themselves with excitement. Even college students can still be motivated to pursue science and engineering careers because of the idea of space exploration. Mm-hmm. A close advisor to the magazine, Leah Jamison, she's the dean of engineering at Purdue University, and she said that every year she asks her incoming freshmen, like, what do you see your engineering legacy being? And this year, for the first time, a majority of the students told her, like, we want to go to Mars. We want to send people to Mars. That would be really neat. That would be really a cool thing to do. Mm-hmm. And then you look at, all these kind of dot-comer millionaires, people like Amazon's Jeff Bezos, the PayPal co-founder Elon Musk, Google's Larry Page and Sergey Brin. They are all huge space buffs. They are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on kind of developing various space ventures. So they clearly see the value in it, and they think it's something that we should pursue. So it's hard to say, one way or the other that the public is motivated.
Jane Kumagai is senior editor at IEEE Spectrum, the magazine for technology insiders. For more on their special issue on Mars, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Jane, thanks very much.
Thank you.
By the way, the astronauts aboard the Space Shuttle Station complex marked today's moon landing anniversary with their own spacewalk. Astronauts David Wolf and Thomas Marshburn hooked up spare parts to the International Space Station. It was the second spacewalk in 3 days. More mundane challenges awaited the astronauts inside, though. Several of them are still trying to fix a broken toilet on the space station. NASA says it's not a serious problem. We'll be back after the news, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As 7-time champion of the Tour de France, Lance Armstrong's strategy is to use the mountain stages of the race to try to break his competitors. This year, one of his teammates is trying to do the same thing to Armstrong. Alberto Contador of Spain, who won the Tour in 2007, could be on his way to a second victory this year. Late in yesterday's first Alpine stage, Contador surged away to claim the yellow jersey. He's also the overall leader after 15 stages, with Armstrong in second place, trailing by 1 minute and 37 seconds. After a rest day today, the final week of the Tour begins tomorrow, with the finish in Paris on Sunday. Bill Strickland is editor-at-large for Bicycling Magazine. He joins us from Lausanne, Switzerland. And Bill, is this race over?
Yesterday, standing at the top of the mountain, watching Alberto come up, it seemed like it was over. But then today, we've all sort of looked at the schedule again, reminded ourselves that three mountain stages to come, which are even harder than yesterday. So a lot of people now are saying that the Tour really started yesterday rather than ended.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of talk about this rivalry with Armstrong and Contador. After yesterday, Armstrong said he'd be happy to be a backup rider. Do you believe that?
I do believe it. He really does respect sort of the code of cycling that you work for the strongest guy. However, you know, Alberto, he's a great rider. He is the most talented bike racer in the world right now, but he has a history of having a bad day. And if that happens, Lance would take advantage of it, I think.
So tell us, what happens when he has a bad day?
Well, he's young and he's kind of hot-headed. A lot of people say he's very impulsive. He wants to win every stage, every race he's in. In a 3-week stage race, you have to be a little more patient. You have to pick your spots. And Alberto sometimes wears himself out, or he'll make a tactical mistake. Whereas, you know, the older racers like Lance, they sort of really wait for riders to make mistakes and sort of pounce on that. So it's, you know, there's a very much a generational difference going on. And that could come into play.
And Alberto actually demonstrated some of that impulsivity last week.
Yeah, he did. He sort of leaped away from the pack. You know, according to who you want to believe, it was either not the team plan or it was not quite the team plan. But it wasn't. It definitely wasn't scripted.
Besides Alberto and Lance, what about some of the other riders? Who are the riders you'll be watching?
The really exciting group here that I think is going to make the race really fun to watch are the Schleck brothers. They're from Luxembourg, and they ride for a team called Saxo, which is run by Bjarne Riis, who is a former Tour winner himself. Next to Johan Brunel, who's the team director of Astana, most people consider Riis the best team director out there, the smartest and savviest. And the Schleck brothers, they're both excellent climbers, so they are really going to go all out on these three mountain stages and work together.
You know, before this started, a Dutch cyclist was banned because of testing positive for an illegal substance. Any issues with substances since this race started?
So far, so good. You know, last year, you know, I would point out that it did take a full week of racing before the first dope positive came back. This year, nothing, and the riders, they've been tested a lot. In fact, one of the ways to really make sure you get time with the top riders is to camp outside the dope control station that's at every finish line, because they're pulling in so many riders these days. Anyone in the top 50 is going to get tested more than normal.
Mm-hmm. So an exciting race this year.
Oh, it's great this year. It's been really unpredictable. There's another young kid, Brad Wiggins from Great Britain, who was an Olympic track cyclist. You know, that's the velodrome, they go around and around. He went out and lost 10 to 15 pounds, and he suddenly transformed into a Tour contender. Last year's winner, Carlos Sastre, is feeling ignored and angry, and so there's a lot of bad blood boiling around, which makes for great racing.
Well, enjoy, Bill.
Okay. Okay, thanks a lot.
Bill Strickland is editor-at-large for Bicycling Magazine. He's also co-author of the book We Might As Well Win with Johan Berniel, team director for Astana, the team of Lance Armstrong and Alberto Contador. Bill is speaking with us from Lausanne, Switzerland, where he's covering the Tour de France. Bill, thank you.
Thanks, Deborah.
Republican lawmakers are stepping up their attacks on President Obama's health care overhaul plans, with Republican Party Chair Michael Steele saying that the plan represents socialism. President Obama maintains that he does not want a government-run health care system, and he holds a roundtable discussion with health care providers today. There are a lot of competing interests in this issue, and most of them have hired former or retired government workers to try to be heard in the health care debate. A Washington Post analysis says the health care industry is spending more than $1.4 million a day on lobbying. Joining us is Dan Egan, who's been following this story for the Washington Post. Dan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Who are we talking about here? Who are some of the big names of the former lawmakers that we might recognize who are now working for some of those who have interests in this debate?
Well, there's two former House Majority Leaders, Dick Armey and Dick Gephardt, Republican and a Democrat, respectively. They both represent a New Jersey drug maker now. And then you've got quite a few other former staffers as well. In fact, hundreds of former staffers who now represent pretty much anybody you can imagine in the healthcare industry.
Hmm. Is the focus on the Finance Committee, which is chaired by Max Baucus? That's sort of the broker in this debate of a lot of these proposals. And is that where a lot of the attention is focused, would you say?
Yes. The Finance Committee in particular has produced a very large number of lobbyists, basically, you know, people who used to work either for the lawmakers who sit on the Finance Committee or for the committee itself. We point out in the story that we wrote, there was, just as an example, one meeting that was held between Baucus aides and lobbyists included two former Baucus chiefs of staff sitting in the room who were, you know, now representing a whole panoply of insurers, drug makers, hospitals, and others. And you've also got a fair number of people who used to be top bureaucrats in, the Department of Health and Human Services, who now work as lobbyists. So they have a lot of connections as well.
Hmm. And you've written, I believe, that was a closed meeting. Is that right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, there are a lot of closed meetings like that where they are, you know, negotiating over strategy, or negotiating over what's going to be in the bill, what should be in the bill, what shouldn't be in the bill. And, you know, people get around the table and argue. But the point is that in this case, many of the people know each other very well. They used to work with each other. They used to be on the same side. And the argument from a lot of critics is that this really distorts the process. Mm. Because whether consciously or not, that you get a better seat at the table when you know the other side.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly that's the appearance. But at this point, is there any evidence that that there has been, I guess, harmful influence on the healthcare debate by some of these folks?
Well, certainly those who advocate for a single payer program, which is the idea that you would sort of scrap our health insurance system and create one national health insurance system, that is not on the table at all right now in the debate. And people who favor that kind of plan argue that this sort of coziness is exactly why it's not being considered, because it would be a major threat to these large healthcare industries if you were to go down that path. So that would be one example of where the argument is that it changes the whole nature of the debate.
Mm-hmm. And I guess the other question is, of course, what about the legality of all of this? And what did we learn from other lobbying scandals? And what was put in place afterwards to prevent any sort of undue or improper influence?
Well, a lot of people would say that's the scandal, is that there is no illegality here. I mean, there are rules in place that forbid former House or Senate staffers from contacting, in a formal, if they become lobbyists, that they're not supposed to contact their former employer for a given period of time. It's a year in the House, 2 years in the Senate. But after that, there's no there's no limits whatsoever. They can act fully as any lobbyist would to try and get meetings, to try and sway a lawmaker to see their position.
And I'm sure that they might argue that they are the folks who have the experience. They know how things run on Capitol Hill. Why shouldn't they capitalize off their past experience to be able to help, guide legislation in a certain way? Really, what's wrong with it?
Well, that is exactly what many lobbyists that we talk to say, that this is that the reason one person, Billy Towson, who used to be a longtime Louisiana member of Congress, who now heads the very powerful Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America group, he compared it to, baseball hiring coaches who used to play baseball or universities who hire from within academia, that basically this is what you should expect, because making laws, debating legislation is very complicated work, and that a given industry, if you're a drug maker, you want to hire someone who knows how the system works and not just hire someone who really is not familiar with Capitol Hill.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of specifics, aside from the public plan that you mentioned earlier, what are some of the specific parts that really seem to be very contentious right now, where folks are really focusing the most attention on trying to influence?
The main point for all of these industries is to basically limit their own exposure to whatever emerges out of all these talks. On the one hand, Obama President Obama and the Democrats have managed to get some agreement from some of these major industries. Pledges of savings or a willingness to take some cuts. But nobody wants to go too far, so a lot of the focus is on these very arcane issues of how you write the legislation, how you set pay rates for Medicare and Medicaid, and all that sort of thing. And a lot of that is still, of course, up in the air. So the battle is still being fought.
And, of course, we have a pullout today showing that President Obama's approval rating on this issue of the way he's handling the health care overhaul has actually gone down considerably.
Yes. It's definitely becoming difficult for him. And he is going to get out in front of this week, and we'll be seeing a lot of President Obama this week trying to push the process forward.
All right. David Egan's been covering the lobbying efforts on the health care overhaul bill in Congress. That's Dan Egan. Sorry about that, Dan. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any of our stories. Go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us or send us an email at letters@hereandnow.org. We'll be back with NPR's music guy, Tom Moon. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. On this 40th anniversary of the lunar landing, a little Pink Floyd. This is Eclipse from Dark Side of the Moon.
All that you touch and all that you see, all that you taste, all you feel.
We thought we'd end the show today by revisiting another Moon, NPR music critic Tom Moon. A number of years back, Tom compiled a book titled 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die, A Listener's Life List. From ABBA to Beethoven, Eminem to Radiohead to ZZ Top and everything in between, including country, world music, and jazz selections. And yes, Dark Side of the Moon is on that list. It's a hefty book, and there's a lot of music in it. In most cases, an item on the list is an entire album. Last November, when we asked Tom Moon to give us a sampling, we also had to ask him, did he actually listen to all of the music he put on this list?
Oh, yeah, and many more besides in culling the list. Someone says, go find us 1,000 recordings. You think, oh, well, I'll just pick my favorites. That'll be easy. That's how I started, and very quickly realized that even if my taste was, say, to be good enough to actually come with that kind of a list, it would be somewhat narrower than what you'd want for a beginning listener or someone just beginning an exploration of music. The first thing I did was go back to records that I was pretty sure would make most reasonable people's lists of great works, sort of the world culture greatest hits kind of records.
The harmonica's play, the skeleton keys and the ray, and these visions of Johanna are now all that remain.
Bob Dylan, Blonde on Blonde, the Beatles records, Miles Davis, Kind of Blue, things that are just sort of in that top shelf category.
So then how do you then narrow it all down? These are the ones, your sort of standards anyway, in your collection. Then how do you, A, narrow that list down and then figure out how to expand it so it's diverse and including things that, and it's not necessarily that you didn't remember them. Maybe you never even heard them before.
That's right. And there's a lot of that in the book. There's a lot of music that I didn't know about that I discovered in the course of sort of journeying. And obviously any book that's going to attempt to address jazz, opera, blues, music from Brazil and Africa and a bunch of other places is not going to have a set criteria. There's no way to say all this music has to do A, B, and C. What I looked for instead was the sense of a peak experience, of some sort of quintessence, something that you couldn't get from almost anything else. And even in listening to Beethoven, there are some recordings of Beethoven where it's just such a singular experience. You're so galvanized by it that it makes it feel like living music.
What music did you discover in this journey that surprised you, that you hadn't heard before, that you had to include in this list because of the peak experience that it represented for you?
The most extreme example I can think of is Celtic music. I was never well-versed in it. I didn't like it. I was never a bagpipe fan or anything like that. I made the mistake of confessing that to my editor, and she said, well, you're not going to ignore this music now, are you? So I actually had to double back and do much more research about Celtic music than I maybe would have had I not opened my big mouth. But it ended up being great because, first of all, I learned that not all of it is the kind of like shrill and or very exceedingly sad or exceedingly happy music that we associate with Celtic music, but actually that there's a lot of stuff in the middle that's beautiful and poignant and relies on the same kind of ensemble interplay that great jazz does. You know, when I heard the early Chieftains records, which I listened to bits of about three or four of them before I ended up with the one that's just called Four, I was blown away. I was like, wow, this is just fascinating ensemble play, and everybody's really, you can tell that they're in it. There's the feeling of life is on the line here a little bit.
The list is so diverse. We should mention, aside from some of the things that you've talked about already, I mean, Janis Joplin is on this list. The Pearl album, yes?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Had to have that one.
Had to have it. You know, and she's another one who she's in with both feet. You feel all of her heart and soul and her life experience when you hear her sing. And you don't have to know her backstory. You don't have to know her associations. You don't have to know who she played with. You hear that voice and the conviction she's bringing. It's galvanizing.
Freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing. That's all that Bobby left me.
And at the same time, you have, for heavy metal fans, you have the Pantera CD, Vulgar Display of Power.
Yeah.
And it is vulgar. And when you describe it, you cite the Ovid quote, a safe pleasure is a tame pleasure.
Right. Well, which it is. And when you hear this record, it's so in your face and there's so much energy behind it that even if you don't like heavy metal, you just really, there's something about it where you have to tip your hat and say, you know what? These guys are totally about this.
Full of grief, I screamed out the wind. Thought I heard the words of fathers.
Let's just talk for 1 second about starting with ABBA and the disc Gold. Have you gotten a lot of grief for that?
I think that if my music critic brethren knew that I liked ABBA even a little bit, they'd take away my card and I wouldn't be able to practice music criticism anymore. But these guys were craftsmen and women on a high level. And this was music that, even if it's very light, is so well done. And there's such accomplishment in it. You don't even have to love it to respect it.
And you could only list 1,000 here, but almost immediately after your list, you have 108 more recordings that you should know about. You just couldn't narrow it down.
Well, and even worse than that, that list was actually about 330, and we only had one page in which to put anything appended. So we were stuck with only 108, but it was heartbreaking even to call that list because these are all incredible works.
You sure look fine tonight in the beer sunlight.
And we leave you with one of those 108 more recordings to know about. This is Joe Ely's Honky Tonk Masquerade. Tom Moon's book is 1,000 Recordings to Hear Before You Die, A Listener's Life List. We spoke with him last November. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Please join us again. Here and Now.
In this honky-tonk